Welcome back. This is your host, Michael Thiemann. We're hosting the OpenSource.com Open Your World Forum. And we're going to start off this afternoon's session with a discussion of Creative Commons in the music industry. We have Daniel James, the director of 64 Studio Limited, and we have Kurt Smith, who is a musician, singer-songwriter, co-founder of a famous band in the 1980s, Tears for Fears, and currently a musician for Brad Sucks. And I would like to turn over to these two to talk about their thoughts on Creative Commons open source and, I'm sorry, I confused two things, sorry. And, in addition, the musician, I'm Brad Sucks, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we also have Ruth Sewell, our moderator. And so, Ruth, hello. Let us begin. Daniel, you'll be first, I presume?
Okay. I've got a short presentation, which is hopefully the first slide can come up now. That is slightly related to Creative Commons, but I'm actually going to be talking about open source and tools for musicians rather than a distribution, as it were. So here's the first slide. This is a quotation from Scroobius Pip, a musician and poet, and he's having a bit of fun here by pointing out that a lot of modern music is considered repetitive and somewhat generic. And in my presentation, I'd like to address some of the possible reasons for that. If I could have the next slide, please. Now, most musicians are currently using proprietary software tools. And this is for a couple of main reasons, I believe. We have a network effect, the problem of file format compatibility, especially for high-level project compatibility. The same sort of problem that you would have with office software, where if you hand a project over to another studio, you want to make sure that it arrives exactly as it was intended to be. So that means you have to use the same software that your collaborators are using. Otherwise, you're going to run into problems. But there's another reason, which is that certain software tools are perceived as professional, and because of that, people believe that if they want to be considered professional, they have to use the same tools, the industry standards, which is the same in many trades. So if I could have the next slide, please. Now, my position is that these proprietary tools have led to homogeneity in the music industry, which has in turn led to a lot of very similar music being produced, repetitive generic music, if you like. Now, the professional audio user, the pro audio user, is quite hard to define in some ways. Now, in certain walks of life, you have to be a member of a professional body, like if you're a doctor or a dentist. Now, those professional bodies exist for musicians, songwriters, producers, and engineers, but it's not compulsory to be a member of one of those organizations. You're not going to be struck off by the Rock and Roll Authority for performing without a license. So that's not necessarily a good way to define what makes a pro audio user. And neither is career length, because a lot of musicians might only make one great record in their lifetime. So you can't define a pro audio user that way. The same goes for income, because some musicians make a lot of money, and lots of musicians make hardly any money. So you can't define professional by their income. And because of computers coming into recording and making music, pretty much anyone these days can set up a studio if they can get their hands on a PC and some basic equipment. So if I could have the next slide, please. I'd prefer to define a professional audio user as someone who creates music or other audio content or works with it, because it might be you might be a producer, you might be an engineer, not necessarily a musician, but you're actually working with this software every day. What defines these people, I think, best of all, is that they have very exacting technical standards for their tools. They will find that errors in timing, glitches, problems with sound quality are completely unacceptable from their software, so that they have high standards. And you'll often hear a producer or an engineer say, you know, whatever computer I use, the sound that comes out has to be exactly the same as the sound that I put into it. So what are the problems with this? Well, if professionals, professional audio users, use the same kinds of software with the same plugins because of these network effects, what ends up happening is that effects become well known to the listening public, and a good example of that would be auto-tune, which you'll hear in a lot of contemporary pop music, and it becomes tiring, it becomes boring, because everybody's using the same effect. Now, it once was that you would have to study a technique in order to copy it. But now, if you want the same effect as someone else using a particular software package, all you have to do is download that and run it and use the preset, and there you have the same sound. There's a lot less effort involved. One of the problems that comes out of this, that sort of compounds it, is that if you go for training at a music school or an audio engineering school, you'll be taught those exact same tools because people expect that if they want a career in the music industry, they have to use the same tools as the professionals. And this, again, reinforces the same effect. So there's a lack of diversity in the tools that are being used. Could have the next slide, please. So here's a quote from Jay-Z, who was a big user of Auto-Tune a couple of years back. And he actually put out a song last year called Death of Auto-Tune, indicating that even he was fed up with hearing the same effects over and over again. Next slide, please. One of the effects of sort of proprietary music software has been that convenience has increased, and one of the factors is the availability of ready-made loops. So these are little segments of music that people can copy and paste and quickly build up a song. Now, these are sold in packs of, 1,000 loops, and you will hear the same loops being used over and over again. These were originally intended for commercial music projects, like, advertising, where things have to be put together very quickly and conveniently, but they're now being sold to musicians to use in their compositions as well. So, again, this is leading to a lack of diversity, in my opinion, and a certain amount of laziness, if you like, has crept in, perhaps, that we can get all of these things sort of on a plate, and we don't have to make much effort to go out and find new sounds or be original. Next slide, please. So my point of view is that true innovators don't rely on industry standard or professional tools. They actually create new tools to use, and in doing that, create new possibilities. Originality is hard work. There are no easy one-click shortcuts, in my view. And if you want to sound exactly the same as everybody else with your music, you can do that. But if you want to be different, you're going to have to put some serious study in. So if I could have the next slide, please. Now, a good example of what I'm talking about is in the picture here, if you can see this on the slide, is Les Paul, who died last year. Not only the innovator of the electric guitar, but also overdubbing, multi-tracking. He's even said to have made his own record-cutting machine from the flywheel of a Cadillac. Now, here in the photo, if you can see that, he's actually got a what looks like a mixing desk with a top open, and he's got a soldering iron. He's working directly on the circuit there, hardware hacking, if you like. And this photo shows, I think, how in the days of analog, machines came apart. You could actually look at the insides, figure out how they worked, improve them, build your own. Next slide, please. And another factor, this is Les again here in the next slide with his guitar, and also another picture of another big device that he's made. Now, magazines like this, Radio Electronics, here, printed circuit diagrams. In a way, they were the open source of their day, because if you wanted to find out how these things were made, if you wanted to build your own, the price of admission was just a copy of a magazine like this. And of course, Les Paul wasn't the only innovator working in this area, but he was remarkably prolific. Next slide, please. This is Daphne Oram, who's the founder of the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop in the 1950s. She didn't last there very long because she wanted to go off and do her own thing. Here she is with some tape machines, probably working on some loops. She's got some oscillators in the background there. So this is early electronic music. Could I have the next slide, please? There's the next slide shows Aramix, which was Daphne's system for sound electronically. And this is a very early graphical user interface based on painting with a paintbrush onto 35mm film, which ran through a machine, which converted using a photocell, converted the painted stripes and wiggles into sound. Next slide, please. So, bring us up to date, open source software offers fewer ready-made tools, loops, and off-the-shelf tools than proprietary software, perhaps, but it does offer total creative freedom for those that have the ability to improve it and hack on it. You don't have to be working in a prestigious university or be in a proprietary software company. If you have the willingness to learn and access to a PC, you can get into it as deeply as you want. Arguably, the laptop is today's guitar or tape machine, and real innovation is possible. One of the great advantages of open source software is that you have a lot of ready building blocks available for creating these new tools. Next slide, please. Now, here's some example of some of the popular tools that artists are using today. Pure Data, which you may have heard of, is a programming language for audio. It allows you to create any kind of synthesizer or media installation using sound and video together. Anything you can imagine basically can be put together with Pure Data. And Super Collider is another similar program which is very popular. On the virtual tape machine side of things, we have Jack, which is the free software audio server that allows you to interconnect between any application. And we have Arda, which is a multi-track tape recorder, the sort of thing that Les Paul might have recognized. And underpinning all these tools, we have the real-time Linux kernel, which is, Red Hat is a major contributor to. We have the advanced Linux sound architecture, providing drivers for many of the professional quality audio hardware that's available. And we have Fofado, which is the similar drivers, but this time for the FireWire audio interfaces, which are often used for multi-track projects. There are many, many more projects out there to be discovered. Next slide, please. One of the most interesting things I think that's going on at the moment is 3D composition. With true surround sound, we don't have just an X and Y dimension. We have a Z dimension and a top-to-bottom dimension. So instead of having speakers just around the room, we have speakers above us and below us as well in the floor. And this allows a composer to use many, many loudspeakers to position sound anywhere in the room using a wave field synthesis, and there are other techniques as well, like ambisonics, that can be used with these programs that I've just mentioned. And I would encourage you to check out an artist who's based in the Netherlands called Tariq Barry, whose URL is up there on the slide. He's actually working on a program that's taken him 2 years to write, which allows him to compose entirely in 3D. There are some great videos on his website to download. And, I mean, obviously, they work best if you have multiple projectors and a full 3D speaker array, but you can get the idea of the kind of work he's doing. The composition is based on objects placed in a 3D universe, and as you pass those objects, fly through the 3D universe, you hear the sound of each individual object. So depending on where the objects are placed, you hear a different piece of music. And it all works in 3D with Doppler effects, and it's all very impressive stuff. Next slide, please. So I did put some links on the slide here, but they're very pale and hard to see. I would just urge you to go to linuxaudio.org and look at the wiki there, which has a lot of applications in it, including links to Pure Data, SuperCollider, ARDA, and these other programs I've mentioned. So final slide, please. So the end of my talk.
Thank you very much. So we'll move on. Should we go to Kurt next?
Either way, I think the next slide has
Kurt, are you ready?
I'm here, yes. Obviously, I'm not doing a presentation as such, but talking about creative... I can talk, yes. I've been known to. Yeah, I mean, I was basically asked to talk about, obviously, Creative Commons specifically, which I've chosen to use for all the solo projects I've been doing. And I guess trying to give a simple version as to why. And actually, you know, giving a simple version sort of really gets the point across about what Creative Commons is about. You know, whereas as an artist, our stuff would be copyrighted, our music would be copyrighted, our records would be copyrighted. And unfortunately, back in the day for me, that would entail being copyrighted by the record company who owned the masters, and also publishing companies. I'm now in the joyful position of owning all those things myself. So then you have to start thinking about, well, how does one go about copywriting one's own work? And I have a great aversion to using lawyers too much. My theory is lawyers have invented this language that only they speak, and consequently we have to hire them to write up these gigantic contracts as to where things can be used and why things can be used. The joy, which I've discovered about Creative Commons, is it's incredibly simple, and it really should be simple because it's plain English. And basically, what I've done with my Creative Commons license is said up front, before you know I release any product, how my product can be used. In my case, if you're not using it for financial gain, i.e., if it's, you know, for a school project or to use in a school play, or those are just a couple of examples, you don't have to come to me and ask for permission. You are welcome to use it as long as I get credited for it. If you are receiving no payment for it, then I require no payment for it. In my book, that's just people being able to use my music, and also it's a small amount of free publicity. As far as anyone using it that may involve commercial gain, it clearly states that if you're making money from it, then you have to come to an agreement with me whereby we share that income source, as it's something I created in the first place. So that makes that simple. And all this is in one page, and I honestly believe that that's the way it should be, and it makes a very simple way for artists, be they musicians, filmmakers, painters, any artist, to clearly copyright their work and then consequently have control over it, but make it simple for people as to how they can use it and what the parameters are. And these are all the reasons why I use Creative Commons and would encourage anyone else who's involved in the arts in any form to use them as well. That's my little speech about Creative Commons.
Excellent. We're going to have a chance to have an extended discussion, but I'd like to give folks a chance to speak first, just get their positions out, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. Does that sound good?
Absolutely.
All right, Brad, are you
Hello
ready?
There. Yes, I am.
Tell us what you want us to know.
What do I want you to know? I mean, my name is Brad, and my band's name is Brad Sucks. It's a solo project. I started out back when MP3s were just, like, it was basically just around when Napster was happening. And I didn't really, before that, I thought the entire process of, you know, getting an A&R guy and or getting noticed by a label and all that sort of stuff seemed really complicated. So, but Napster and MP3s and everything made me realize it was just about making these little files. So I started out pretty relaxed about my rights. Like I gave everything away free, and I basically just wanted these little files to spread out through the universe. My first contact with, I guess there were two first contacts. That's impossible. But I got into CC Mixter and put my source on there, and people began remixing my music, and that was pretty awesome. You know, it was like hundreds and hundreds of remixes have been made on there. And then I was in a Creative Commons record label named Magnatune. So I was giving away the source and giving away the music and all that sort of stuff, and then my stuff came to be licensed under Creative Commons, which was fine. I mean, I started off very relaxed about that stuff, so I almost thought it was Creative Commons was sort of unnecessary. In that, like, I don't know, I'm cool with it. Just do whatever you want. Leave me alone. I don't want to, you know, much like Kurt, I really do not really care for lawyers. I don't really like having to deal with any of that stuff. And so I just thought, you know, hey, we're on the internet here. Just do whatever. You know, if you make $1 million, be cool. But that's about it. But then I did a video contest last year or the year before. For a song off my last album, and I wanted people to act out. The name of the song was Fake It, and I wanted people to like sort of dance along and act goofy while they lip sync it. And for that, it was useful as I was like putting this whole thing together and making sure people were cool with me using their clips on my website. I wasn't using it for any. Not going on a DVD or anything, but it was just a fun thing. And for that, it was Creative Commons was really useful to me. It just made it very clear to everybody what was going on and what they could expect and what I could expect, and that was really helpful and kind of made me appreciate it more. And then with my next album, I'm actually releasing the demos as I go. And I'm giving away you can download the source for the vocals and the instrumental. And I'm kind of opening it up to like pre-mixing. So the idea is that I'll work on these demos and people will hopefully remix them as I go, maybe improve them or something. And then I'll get together at the end once I'm done the whole thing and go through what people have worked on and then try and collate them all together into something a little bit more interesting than what I would have done on my own. But whether that will work or not, I have no idea. But that's what I'm trying to do. So that's pretty much my history with Creative Commons.
Fantastic. And I certainly remember when you sort of were one of the first breakout artists of CC Mixture, and you really helped bring a lot of notoriety to the site. I want to ask a question that people used to ask me all the time. I started the world's first open source company back in 1989, and when I told people I was selling commercial support for GNU software, they would say, yeah, but what's your real job? And number one, that showed a lack of understanding of how much money can be made commercializing open source technologies, but it also really disrespected just how many hours I was working on that job. It was hard. And so, Brad, a question I want to ask you, you know, when people, you know, your little bio says you're a one-man music production, but I would like to ask, is this, in fact, your full-time paying gig to be a creative musical person, or are there other things that you do in this 21st century age when most musicians can't make any money?
Well, I mean, I live off of the music. That's my primary job, but I have other things that I'm involved in. I mean, I don't know too many people these days involved in arts or anything that don't have, especially internet and open source-y type people that don't have a lot of other irons in the fire. So I've got things like, I mean, I wrote my own digital download store when I was trying to have my own download store on my website, and so I have web programming and stuff. That's how I came to get in on everything on the ground floor, because I was ultimately just a huge nerd. So I still do some of that stuff and some a bit of consulting here and there, but primarily it's the music.
Fantastic. And we've got some questions coming in online, but I'm dying to ask this question of Kurt with respect to the lawyers. So I had a chance to be in a room full of lawyers a couple of weeks ago. Red Hat was sued in East Texas over a patent case, and we won so much that we actually invalidated their patent, so that was great. But in the course of that discussion, when we were having the judge was having particular difficulty with the way the lawyers from the other side were viewing our open source model. And one of the, for me, the highlight of the whole trial, and this actually happened all off camera, but the judge recognized, he had an insight, and he exclaimed to the court, it was not technically the court because the jury wasn't there, but he exclaimed, "I get it. You guys, meaning Red Hat, are like the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead did not make money directly from their music. They made money from all the peripheral activities that were associated by this. And so the Grateful Dead didn't chase away people who were bootlegging their stuff, but actually gave them a privileged position so that they could make and share better quality tapes." And I was quite pleased by that, because that was an early motivation for me in switching from a concept of, you know, the only way to make money in software is proprietary to we really can build a business around it. But I am kind of curious where you personally are drawing the line between what constitutes commercial use or non-commercial use of your music, and what are the kinds of, you know, do you see that being a bright line or a very fuzzy line when it comes down to if you walk into a bar in London and you hear your music being played and it's the most popular bar in London, are you happy about that, or do you feel that they cut you out of the deal?
Well, let me just answer one specific bit of your question. It's an incredibly fuzzy line. And that's purely because it really is down to the individual, and so I can only speak for myself. Obviously, there is a license out there, a Creative Commons license, but, you know, to a certain extent, that can be a little fuzzy. I mean, if I discover, giving your example of my music being played in the most popular bar in London, am I going to go up to the bar owner and say, "Are you paying this performing rights company, because I need to know?" No, I'm not, because I'm just happy it's being played there. And that income source is not that huge from that specific bar. So to go to that point, I mean, I'm guessing you would basically deal with it on a sort of case-to-case basis, because if I found some kid was if someone brought my attention to the fact that some kid somewhere actually was selling something with a little sample of me in, and I go there and find, you know, 20 people have maybe downloaded it, am I going to care? No, not particularly. If I discover that, you know, insert huge conglomerate du jour here, has been using something that I worked on and spent a lot of time and money on in a big commercial and hasn't recompensed me, then yes, I'm going to throw a shit fit. So those are two different examples.
Got it. Well, it's more of just a, you know, curiosity for my own sense, because it is certainly a question that a lot of folks, both in the open source world and the Creative Commons world, struggle with, which is, you know, which boundary is operative. Let me go to one of the online questions. This is for Daniel, and the question is,
okay,
what open source tools are quote unquote nearly there, and which still have a long way to go?
I would say the one that I use most is Arda, which I mentioned in the talk there. That's a very mature application. It's very reliable for many channel recordings. I would say, Pure Data has a huge community, including a lot of people that it's brought in from outside the open source world. I mean, Pure Data is even available on the iPhone, so you can actually design synthesizers and do all kinds of projects on there. It's available from the App Store as a free download, I believe. So they're two examples of things that are very already very mature. The things that are nearly there, some of the synthesizers are known to be a little flaky at times, but you know, they are you know, constantly improving, so that's good. One of the things that people do miss from the proprietary world is a sort of all-in-one ready-made music type application like Reason or GarageBand or something like that. But for the reasons I indicated in my presentation, I actually don't really miss having those applications a lot, because I think the creativity is done best when it's done with dedication and effort. And if you make making music too much of a so-called consumer experience, then if you make it too easy, too dumbed down, then you actually do a disservice to music.
Great, thanks. So another question from online, this is from one of our speakers later today. Carson Wade is asking questions. I think this is probably for you, Kurt, and for you, Brad. But do you have any worries about the non-commercial clauses of Creative Commons, such as people not remixing because they're worried about violating the NC clause? You know, where do you see the line between stifling innovation and, you know, protecting your interests?
Well, I guess I'll speak briefly. I think that, you know, the whole point is you do have to protect your interests to some degree. I don't believe any of us want to stifle creativity in any way, shape, or form, because we're inherently creative people. We wouldn't be musicians otherwise. But again, if someone really is basing a track on your music, then yes, you deserve to share in any financial rewards that may ensue from that music. You know, let me give you a case in point, which I think, you know, a lawsuit's still going on about, where Kanye West used the Tears for Fears track called Memories Fade, which actually, you know, we play live and some young kids think it's a Kanye West track. That's how close it is to the original. All he did was change the lyrics, and yet was demanding, you know, 70% of the publishing, which is absolute nonsense. It's absolutely 100% the same song, sampled from the record, and all he did was change the lyrics, kept all the melody. So, yes, you have to retain some creative control and some choice over about what people do with your music. That having been said, I still go back to the fact that it's a fuzzy line. You deal with it on a case-to-case basis. But I think if someone's going to base their music around something you have created as an artist, if that artist is being as honest as you are, then they will, one, give you credit, and two, share the spoils of that creativity with you.
I mean, if I may make a follow-up point on that, I think under the conventional copyright system, it's one thing to be able to say, oh, I own 100% of this exclusively and you may not sample it. It's another thing being able to legally enforce that. It's actually quite expensive to go with your lawyers again, chasing around the world for payment from various people. And the old system was far from perfect. I mean, there was a mention of going into a bar and confronting the bar owner. Well, I just heard the other day that Nina Simone used to do exactly that in the 80s when My Baby Just Cares for Me was re-released. She used to go into record shops where it was playing and say, give me my money. But of course, what had happened is that when she made the record, she did it for a one-off studio fee and was never paid any royalties. So when people criticize open source models or Creative Commons models, they have to put into perspective the fact that the old system was hardly perfect.
Great. There's a couple of other online questions, but there's one I want to ask, which really relates also to this. Speaking again of lawyers, and of course, Larry Lessig was the founder of Creative Commons, and he came to the problem as a lawyer. And over the years, he's written a number of books, starting from an extremely legalistic perspective, and ultimately achieving an almost humanistic perspective in Remix, which he published, I think, 3 years ago. But I discovered last year a book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde. And The Gift actually basically predicts everything that Creative Commons had become 25 years before it was founded. And I wonder, from your perspectives as artists, how the over industrialization, the sort of the marginalization of the gift culture versus trying to prescribe everything. If you see the reemergence of balance as being something that could actually be beneficial both to the folks who are pursuing traditional models as well as to the folks who are pursuing the non-traditional models. Are either of you familiar with that book, its premise, and how it may apply to your particular economic and cultural values?
No one's jumping in here.
Well, I'm not familiar with the book, but I don't know, just to kind of answer the non-commercial question and maybe a bit of that one as well, that I don't know, I mean, I'm operating from strictly, post-Napster, starting off. I wouldn't have anything in my little career if it were not for the internet and for openness in general. So I tend to just take a everything's good mentality. I mean, I'm open to the idea that one day I could become completely bitter and I'll be walking around to bars and yelling at people and demanding my money and stuff. Like, it's perfectly possible. I have no idea. But so far, the tactic of just being cool with it and seeing where things go. And the other aspect is that I think of it in sort of capitalist terms as well. Like, I mean, I don't want to sound like too much of a jerk, but it is so beneficial to me to have people making remixes and doing videos and doing all this sort of stuff. Like, I couldn't possibly. I don't have a PR firm. I don't have anybody doing that stuff for me. So, without that stuff, I would have nothing, and I don't really have a plan for how to do anything without it. So when it comes to like some line of non-commercialness, I'm like, I don't know. I if it were millions of dollars, I would probably cry and stuff. But otherwise, I tend to just think, I don't know, I have a strangely, for sort of a bigger person, I have a strangely optimistic view of it. Just, good things will happen. You put stuff out there, it moves around. Weird things happen all the time. my music. I think of my music as being independent from me. It just sort of moves around on its own and gets up to weird adventures and then comes back and surprises me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the end, I mean, if I can interject, that in the end there just will be some balance. You know, and I'm all about having a balance. I think that the old model was farcical, which was completely proprietary, but not proprietary to the artist, unfortunately. It was proprietary to the record companies who controlled our music. Publishing companies controlled the publishing. The record companies then went out and became proprietary as to where you could attain that music or their product, as they called it, you know, which was owning retail, i.e. positioning in retail. This is before the internet obviously was invented. Owning radio, they were the only ones with the money that could bribe radio to play their records. So not only were they proprietary in ownership of the product, which was our music, they were proprietary as to how that was distributed. With the internet and what's been happening over the last few years, it's been completely turned on its head. The upside of it, that the people that now are becoming slightly proprietary, and I think there has to be a balance, are going to be the artists, which, you know, create the music, and yes, we would like ownership of our own music. We have spent, you know, I've spent most of my lifetime up until the last 10 years where someone else has owned my music. You know, I'm kind of enjoying owning my own music, and I get to make the choice as to how that music is used. So I'm slightly proprietary about it, but nowhere near to the extent that record companies were or publishing companies were, which means that, you know, I'm kind of pretty loose about it. But I do believe that in the end, obviously, artists have to devise some source of income from what they create. Otherwise, they can't continue to create unless we're all willing to, you know, have jobs as well and just create in the evenings when we have some free time. That's my humble opinion.
I have an opinion, and in fact, Brad, to the comment that you made, just as Kurt gave his answer, that concept of letting the music be independent and then be enriched, you know, in its journey through culture on its way back to you, is a central premise of this book, The Gift, which looks at how that culture of giving and magic actually was thriving until relatively recent days, relatively recent being about the end of the Reformation. and it's absolutely a fascinating book. Does anybody want to share any other thoughts that they wish we had covered in this session? We've got just a couple of minutes left before we go on to open source, open standards, and healthcare. But
I mean, I do, you know, one of the joys I will say from, you know, everything being so easily accessible and is actually working with other musicians, I have to say, which sort of hasn't, you know, I mean, we've mentioned sort of working with people that may make videos for your, you know, on the internet or remix stuff on the internet. But the, you know, a joy of social networking and the internet is actually meeting other people also, you know, and I've been actually doing a couple of collaborations recently where there are people I've just met through social media. You know, Zoe Keating is one, who's this amazing cello player, who's a new mom. Congratulations, Zoe. Another one I'm working with is Melissa Kaplan, who I found through the internet also, and that side of it is actually giving me great joy. The availability for me to discover and meet other creative people is actually quite wonderful.
Fantastic. There's one last question, which is, I think, Brad, you have answered this, but let me just ask you directly so you can give us a straight answer. Do you belong to any organization or association protecting musicians' rights or fighting against online music piracy? I think that's a yes or no question.
Interesting. I'm trying to think of what sordid connections I have. I believe
connections, that kind of thing.
Yes. I think I'm actually a member of SOCAN, which is, I think your equivalent down there is in the States is ASCAP or BMI. And I've been kind of debating getting rid of that, but so far it hasn't really impeded me or helped me in any way. So I don't know, it was just something I kind of did early on, and that was about it. I just was experimenting with it.
Well, great. Well, I want to thank all of you for participating. We have the Red Hat Summit coming up in Boston in about a month in June 22nd through the 25th. And one of the things that punctuates every presentation is music that we discover from Creative Commons. And so I think we've got a few people who are going to be voting to get some of your stuff in there. And, Daniel, if you've got any great production values coming out of your software, you ought to let us know.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for inviting me on.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks, Kurt, and thanks, Brad.
Thank you.